Good morning. My name is Billy Hogue, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Suburban Men's Group in Louisville, Kentucky. We meet on Tuesday nights. Now, I've told you, as my friend Raymond P. O'Keefe, the professor, used to say, who's passed along, I've told you who I am and what I am and where I belong. I belong here. It's okay for me to be here because I'm mightily alcoholic. And I've been safe, sane, and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous since November the 1st, 1980. And I tell you about those 28 years to impress you. Not with who I am, but with the power that's available in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is an amazing thing. And I do love it, and I need to thank the people that had the great good sense to ask me to be here, especially Billy. Billy's been kind of bird-dogging us for a year. And to get my dear sponsor here, who you're going to hear this afternoon, and if you haven't heard him, it's a powerful, powerful message. And he also keeps his voice up real good, so you'll be able to hear him, even if you hear like he does, which is not very well. We got to drive over here together yesterday, and it's always tickles me pink to be with my best friend and my sponsor. Doesn't usually work out that way, but your best friend can be your sponsor. It's not likely. I need to tell you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. And I always get tickled with this idea I'm supposed to tell you what happened. What happened is pretty much the same story. There's only one story. You get really, really bad drunk and addicted, and then you come to Alcoholics Anonymous or you die. It's the only one story, you know. But I'll tell my saga. Don always tells me that I'm to tell you not what it was like, but what I was like. What it was like may have been entirely different for you and me. But our feelings, you might be able to identify a little bit. My factual story is so unique. Actually, I suspect here in Shenandoah, beautiful, beautiful Hebron, Shenandoah Valley, that might be kind of similar. My dear Don said I was really, really boring. The only thing I ever did was Alcoholics Anonymous and work. So he made me get a hobby. So I said, well, what hobby have you got? And he said, well, Civil War. I went, okay. And I did it like I do everything. I went out and got your basic 150 books. And there's more books written about Civil War than anything else. Then I really learned it. You know, I had that Ken Burns tapes. That's the way I learned a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous, quite frankly. I have always stalked the people who gave me a powerful message and sat at their feet. I made a point of finding them. So if you recognize every single thing I say, you've listened to a lot of tapes, too. But what happened? Well, I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and it's kind of like out of the Great Gatsby. You know, we fancy ourselves a kind of sophisticated home of bourbon whiskey, of course. And I drank some of that. My parents had many advantages, many, many advantages. And I was heir to some of them. When I was 6 years old on July the 23rd, 1953, I was playing catch with my little sister. She's about this tall. Her name was Annie. And we were playing catch up on the third floor of a house they were building next door to my parents. And you know, when they build the floors out in a new house, they build them out and then they stud it and then there's no drywall. And I pushed little Annie and she fell three flights and she was crushed on a concrete floor. And 9 days later, she died. And I don't know exactly what that did to me, but I know what it did to my mama. It crushed her. And she had a very hard time living in this world. She was a bad alcoholic. Of course, her name was O'Brien. And but I used to tell that story. And I used to say, if you've got an excuse, you too can forfeit your life to this disease. And a fella came up to me and he said, I suspect you've never lost a child. We only talk about our own experience, strength, and knowledge, but Billy gave me license a couple minutes ago. I could tell you any story I wanted. I only got this one story, so I'll try to stick to it. I came out of that. My mother went in her first institution. And then my father, I lost his family business because my grandfather closed it down. And then things were pretty rocky. And we had the rules in the alcoholic family. Don't talk. What are we going to talk about? You know, Annie dying. Why mother didn't show up for the driving group. You know, why mom's throwing up in the bathroom. I mean, what are you going to talk about in an active alcoholic family? I'm what's called a double winner, which I think is the most ridiculous classification I've ever heard. In fact, what I am is God's pretty much most unwilling Al-Anon. If not unwilling, then most unsuccessful. And but, you know, in alcoholism, we get driven there. It's, you know, we didn't sassay over there, you know. We didn't just come on in. You know, we had a gun in our mouth, you know. Whenever they have a TV show and they want to show you terror, they show you the gun in the mouth, you know. That's the way we got here. I got here anyway. And Al-Anon, they just beat you to death. So I have to tell a little bit of that story because that's pretty much of my story for the last 7 years. And I don't know how those intertwined stories cannot be told in tandem. I went to my first shrink in the third grade because I was wet in the bed. And they had put my sheets up on the side of the cabin at camp. And then they put my name on. And that made me mad as hell. And I stayed mad as hell until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And a little while after I got here. I love those people coming in AA. You know, the guys I sponsor, you know, you keep coming back. You're doing great, you know. All I've got to do is write it down on a piece of paper and give it to somebody else. Now, that's magic. That's magic to me. And I love to watch it happen. I'm one of those people who are very, very fortunate. I know the only reason in the world God let me get out of the jackpot was so I could 12-step. I know that for a fact. I was asking myself, what am I doing here? You know, everybody wants the big question. And I know what I'm supposed to be here for. I'm supposed to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I kept falling uphill. And in the eighth grade, I was out beating this kid's head on the ground in the parking lot. And they picked up a little on anger. And so they asked me to go to another school, and they sent me to a school my father really could ill afford at the time. And they were already a year ahead of me in Latin. So I didn't know any Latin. So I copied off of this guy next to me. But he didn't know any Latin either. So consequently, I was branded as a cheat. And I don't know about you all, but I always needed to cheat some. Because I just need a little help. Need a little edge. Because I wasn't enough. I've had this secret since I've been awake. I'm not enough. That's my secret. And I'm not going to do it right, and you're not going to like me, and you're going to make me go away. Well, the next rule is don't trust. Only idiots trust active alcoholics. You've got to be close to brain dead. Trust them, but I'm going to prove to you that's possible. And then don't feel. And for my money, there's just nothing quite like three big mouth, loud mouth vodka martinis. You know, that'll make you not feel. So I didn't know that was going to be my path, but I knew it had been my poor mother's. Been her sister. She died at 50 years old. She was married to the president of Gillette. She had something to live for. And my mama, she went to Sarah Lawrence, and she was a little junior editor at Vogue magazine. She had something to live for. But she had a terrible time. She spent about half her life in the Institute of Life in Hartford, Connecticut, where Baby James Taylor wrote Fire and Rain. Just yesterday morning, I heard you died. And she liked it because it was a prestigious jitter joint. And it's also because it was down the street from my Aunt Carrie, whose husband founded the Pratt & Whitney Aircraft Company. And so it was a comfortable place to go on your weekend pass. And she spent about half her adult life there. She used to say, I can't be sober. Don't you understand? I lost my little Annie, you know. Don't you understand? And I kept falling uphill, which has been my way in spite of myself. And I had my first drink. There, we start drinking in Louisville around 13, 14. And then we start drinking with our parents at 16. Active parties back then. Now it's a crime to do what parents used to do in Louisville. But who am I to make commentary? Our book wishes us to not be controversial. And goodness knows that's always my objective. I'm a divorce lawyer. That's not a defect of character. It's just a way to make a living between meetings, you know, and then send a bill for it. Anyway, I kept falling uphill, and I supposed to tell you what I was like, and it apparently involves describing some drinking. It fascinates me that people think you would lie about that, you know. And what the kids call it is out-bottoming you, you know. My story's worse than yours. I have more car wrecks and more divorces and more bankruptcies, you know. I win. But I had every advantage. And I started going to those debutante parties, and I'm 16 years old, and free booze, all you could drink. And I went to one. I came back from college just to go to this one. I'd only been away at college for a week. And I pulled up in front of the media family's home, quite magnificent. And I kind of jammed my way into the people had parked much too close together. And so I jammed my way into there and kind of got a drunk bump on the car. And then I went in and I had a tray of liquor. They weren't matching. They were just a tray full. And then I was out dancing with the hostess, and I threw her out. I was a vigorous dancer. I was not a good dancer. So I threw her out kind of, and I lost her. And damn, she didn't kind of slide up against the wall and hit her head. And she was about 65. I knew almost immediately I needed to leave. And so one of my dearest friends had just gone off the cliff there at Washington and Lee. And his face was all cut up. And so they tried to take my keys away. I just love that. Trying to take keys away from an alcoholic. That's like a just say no, you know. It's just ridiculous. So I, of course, drove myself, and I went down the hill, and I kind of got a little off the road, and I ran into these great big stone pillars. Yeah, that was kind of hard on the car. And then I could turn left and go to my parents' house about 8 blocks away, or I could turn right and go to Cincinnati. Don't get ahead of me. So I woke up just back to Cincinnati, and my ride was going to pick me up. And damn, it was daylight. And so I needed to scoot back. I got back, and I had thrown up in the pocket of my tuxedo because I didn't want to mess the car up and have my father figure out how we got all those drunk bumps on it. So I ran upstairs, and I put the bag, and I put my tuxedo in the bag. And just put it up in the closet. And then I went down and told my father about the 3 hit and runs. And then I had to get out of there real quick, so I did. And that was the first time we went to breakfast, and we went to something called a Toddle House. I don't know if you all ever had a Toddle House, but a little diner. And we went in there, and of course we were regaling the story the night before. And somebody put that little card in my pocket, and it said, "Get help." I was just 18. So I've always maintained that I never had a clue I was alcoholic until I got here. As I told you, not very teachable. My friend Don describes God's grace as a moment of teachability. I love that. Matter of fact, he helped me with that. I was against the grace thing for a long time here. Supposedly, a Catholic priest had told my mother the reason my little sister died was because my father was a Protestant. And he was called Saint Bill. He stuck in there with my mother for 47 years. So I kept falling uphill. I went to my first day of law school. And I had to be a lawyer. I cheated my way through math and wasn't going to be an accountant, you know. And I could be a glib alcoholic. I'd get away with that. And the first day of law school, I had a big rush party. And I took everybody back to my house. I'm a cheerleader. I've got to be because I want everybody to like me. I need everybody to like me. And so I took everybody back there, and I announced we were going skinny dipping. And there was not a great response. And so I dropped all my clothes there in the living room to make my point. You know, we are going skinny dipping. And a couple of idiots got in a car with me, and we drove around to this country club, and we were going to jump in the pool. And I saw some young people making love underneath the paddle tennis courts. So I wanted to put some light on them, you know, me being a prince of a guy. That's what Don always calls me when we talk about these tacky little things that happen. And so I put the car in reverse, and I backed up real quick because I was going to put the lights on, and I went over the cliff. And it rolled down the cliff, and then the car caught on fire. And, you know, to this day, I don't believe those police officers or the firemen or the big burly wrecker driver that drove me home, I really believe that I had lost my car, my clothes trying to put out that fire. But I went to my first day of classes with both my hands wrapped in bandages. I knew there was a price for drinking. Like I told you, my mama's name was O'Brien. My father's, my last name is Hogue. And that's really, really Scottish. You know, I love this discussion about willpower by those people out there. It's like, don't give up. It's like, give me your keys. And, you know, being Scottish, we never gave up. And we were right next to the English that conquered the rest of the known world. We never gave in. I'll show you some willpower, though. I want you to consider what I was willing to do to keep drinking. There's some willpower. You know, kind of cut my toe off one time on Sunday after Derby. You party during Derby week, and you liable to get drunk a couple of times a day. And I ran into my old buddy Don that day. He was, I think he was getting over a little hangover himself, actually. But I had wrapped my foot in a towel because I wanted to call on this young lady with my toe just bleeding like, and, you know, it was kind of a wet towel. And needless to say, she was not all that pleased with me courting her, especially since I was married. And I always like to tell the Al-Anons just so they can see that I'm not kidding about what a prince of a guy I was when I was drinking. My first wife put me through law school, which I thought was good of her. And then I told her it wouldn't be necessary for her to attend my graduation because I already had another date. I've never had an Al-Anon woman that wasn't willing to smack me right after that. And well-deserved is a classic example of the selfishness that I have found in me. I wrote that woman, this big, long amend, very elaborate. Of course, it had to be the first one. And very elaborate letter. I've been told, don't call on me. And she wrote me back this little letter. She just said, glad to hear you're sober. Have a good life. Goodbye. That's it. So, you know, sometimes those men's are not nearly as big to the other people as they are to us. And you always have to remind a sponsor, you know, I don't care if they wanted to throw you through the window. You know, that's not about what this amend is about. It's about changing who you are. That, in my judgment, is what the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous do for me. They change who I am. Hopefully you'll discover that I'm not that way today as much. And I'm going to law school and keep falling uphill. And I got to accelerate this because I got to get into page two. You know, Paul Harvey passed away. But page two is really exciting. I did some pretty bad drinking. You figured out, I like to take off my clothes a lot. And so I was in much better shape. Come on. And I was going down through the Cochrane Tunnel. You know, there's a tunnel, and there was about 6 inches of snow on the ground, and my date was naked, and I, of course, didn't have any clothes on, and we were going about 65, and I decided right out of that tunnel is an exit that went to my house. I decided we better go home and pick up some few things before we take off on the private airplane. We were going to Stowe, Vermont, where I did my last ski. It was on nosedive. I remember that clearly. though I was mighty drunk there too. And though the United States Attorney Sandy told me that I was alcoholic, I dropped a gallon of that wine. Remember the wine you used to be able to buy at Boone's Farm or something? I dropped a gallon of that in the hot tub. And you know, it was back when you had glass. It was kind of a mess. And I get over this little hump, and I'm going down the exit, and I see there's a car parked at the bottom of the hill. And it's about 2:30 in the morning. And so I say, well, it's going to be a hit. And boom. Made me real nervous because I was the chief prosecutor. You know, the chief prosecutors always get the best dope. And so I just about knocked them to Cincinnati. But fortunately, he wasn't with his wife either. Go along. I'll take care of mine. You take care of yours. I always thought that was a fair way to resolve alcoholic difficulties. You know, when you're Irish and you say, I was drinking, that's pretty much a complete defense. You know? Oh, well, you were drinking. Yeah, okay. You know? So it keeps getting worse and worse. I'm in this sailboat, and that wouldn't have been bad, but we didn't have any life preservers, and it was dark, and it was snowing. That was the problem. We had this light in the sail. We thought it was very clever, you know, snow coming down, pretty as it could be. So I turtled the boat. I used to get a little excessive when I was drinking. And so Don says I'm still a little excessive. So I flip over the boat, but the stove was unhooked up because it was the middle of winter. And it had been dry docked. And so the stove fell through the top of the boat. And it just went down just like a rock. We would have been toast, but this fella had been watching us from up on the hill. Mother, come see these idiots, you know. they had the police out there in about 4 or 5 minutes, and it was real lucky. You have a tendency to get hypothermia when it's snowing. And I was taken to the hospital to intensive care for quite a while. They thought I had a bleed in my head. The boom had hit me in the back of the head, and I had this terrible hangover. I said, come on, God, come and get me. If now's the time, I'm not going to be a hypocrite. I'm not going to say you exist today. I'd already been through the priest, you know. I already made up my mind on those issues. Plus, the Catholic Church is against a bunch of stuff that I was in favor of. And a fellow pointed out to me, Gary B. from Indiana, is a great, great AA, and a member of the Fellowship of the Spirit, and the old Don Pritz and that crowd. And he called me up to the front of a retreat we started together, actually. And he said, Billy, you know, you ought to come up and help us with the fourth step. And, well, okay. We talked about our conception of God the night before. And I got up there and said, yeah, we called up Billy here because he's an example of what a horse's ass you can be taking the fourth step and fifth step. It wasn't exactly what I thought he was calling me on me for. And he said, yeah, Billy decided to condemn the entire Catholic Church and God. Rather than just being mad at the priest. It's always been helpful to... you ever notice how we hate everything about something that we felt was a wound, you know? Well, I was having a lot of trouble. It was getting worse and worse. And my second wife had to leave me. She said, Billy, I can't stand stay around and watch you die. And she's a lawyer for Disney today. Damn, I missed that one. Then it happened, you know. What happened? I was going to this shrink, and he told me I had to quit drinking, or he wasn't going to see me. And so I said, all right, I'll take Antabuse. I watched my mother drink on Antabuse, and I may be wild and crazy, but I'm not stupid, and I won't be drinking on Antabuse. I thought that was the end of the discussion, you know, proven. And so he gave me a great big Antabuse that knocked out a horse, and they couldn't even fill it at the prescription place because it was such a big dose. And it irritated me. He didn't trust me. And I think he wanted it to, like, knock me over and put me in a hospital bed if I had a beer, you know. And so I couldn't stop long enough to take the Antabuse. And I used to say, well, I wasn't really powerless over alcohol, and I wasn't really defenseless against the first drink. I just couldn't stop for a month and a half, long enough to take the Antabuse. So I turned my will and my life over to Antabuse. That's what I did. And about a month later, a very, very beautiful woman invited me to a party because she was a friend of my little sister's. My little sister told her I wasn't drinking. And I said, I'll have a soda and lime. And she said, I heard you weren't drinking. I said, yeah. And she said, well, come with me. And she proceeded to 12-step me for the next 5 hours. And nothing in my life has been the same since. Nothing in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous changes who you are. And I love being able to nudge your sponsor. You know, it's fun to be able to kind of nudge her, and she was a great sponsor. But then she got drunk, and she had 5 years of sobriety. So just remember, it's a two-way street on this 13th step, and people. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and Don and I can do a whole week on end on it, and I get my 2 hours in that time. And I want to shift gears here for you just real quick, because Billy kept me down to an absolutely unreasonable amount of time. I had been through a couple of women. As soon as a woman cared for me, I would dump her, because then she had just proven how stupid she was. And I met a number of people. NAA in particular made me really popular, you know. Scarlet sponsor sure loved me. You know, gal that 12-stepped me. So I meet this gal, and I started my saga of going through adult children process. Lasted 5 years. I did 4 weeks of inpatient treatment. I went to a therapist every Tuesday to group. And then Don said, Billy, Butterow, let's think about this for a minute. How can being self-centered be the answer to being self-centered? Oh. Got a point. Plus, I paid a whole lot of money. I could go to AA for free. And so I started into it, and I met this gal, and she announced we were getting, we needed to have a baby. We got married, pretty much with a gun at my back. And we got married. I said, a baby? What are you talking about, Al? What are you talking about? You know, I'm 47 years old. A baby? You know. So I have this little 14-year-old little girl now. Her name is Alexandra Ann. That's named after my little sister. And A.A. Hogue. Get it? So she's 5'10" and real smart, blows the top off all these tests. And so everybody thinks it's pretty damn funny. I'm 62 and I got a 14-year-old, you know. But nobody's jealous. Here I've been brought up in this alcoholic family, and I've been alcoholic and terrorized these women that I was married to, and then and some others. And then I got this wife, and we're having this baby. And Don told me, Billy, put a rope. We need to think about this for a minute, because what respectable guy our age doesn't pay child support on at least one child, you know? So quit worrying about it. It's no big deal. It's one day at a time. And that's been pretty much, sometimes 1 minute at a time, the experience of fatherhood for me. My wife started drinking after 11 years of sobriety. My little girl came and got me. She said, "Daddy, come with me." And so we had to go up to the church, which was, and school, which was right next to our house. And her sponsor said, "You got to help me get Carolyn home. She's too drunk to walk." What? She got 12 years of sobriety. What do you mean, too drunk to walk? We hang out with Clancy and Raymond. What do you mean? Well, she's still drunk. So I started this idea. It's none of my business. It's all God's business. He's in charge of that. Stay out of her program. None of your business. I was the Sunday morning speaker for something called the International Lawyers in AA. I had started the American Bar Association Commission on Lawyers Assistance Program. And there was about 12 years later, and they finally asked me to speak. And so we went out there. It was the week of 9/11. And she got, you know how you get the book at the conventions? You know, everybody signs the book, and then the oldest person gives the youngest person the book. And she got the book that year and the next year. And the next year. And we were at my little sister, my little girl's birthday. And we were in Aspen, Colorado. Couldn't have been any prettier. And she was driving about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And we went off the road and we went through all this terrain. And we just barely missed a parked dump truck. And damn near died. And my host said, "Well, you know she's drunk, don't you?" Wow, that was August the 3rd, 2004, and I 2003, and I couldn't stop crying. I was going to lose her, and I never meant to be emotionally available. You know, that was not my original plan, getting married. You know, I've been through that before. It's a nice project, but I couldn't stop crying. I called up Ernest, who's this wonderful black sponsee of mine, who's a medical doctor, and his story is just beautiful. And he was the youngest of 10 in an abusive alcoholic father's home, and he's a spiritual giant. And I called him up and I said, "Ernest, I can't quit crying." And I kept going up the mountain. The reception was great, and I said, "I can't stop crying. I'm falling apart." He said, "Man, you can't do that. You're supposed to be my guru. What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm going to lose her." And so he said, "Well, Bill, I was doing what you suggested. And I've been meditating every morning. And not long ago, I was reading the story of Paul. And Paul had this stake in his side. It wasn't a thorn. It was translated properly. It was a stake. Put you in the mind of alcoholism." And he went to God and he said, "God, I don't have enough faith to to do your work. You've got to remove this stake. And God said, nope. He said, you don't understand. I do not have enough faith to do this work with this thorn in my side. And God said, my grace is sufficient. It better be. You get to Al-Anon in a real big way. God's grace better be sufficient, huh? Because if AA and Al-Anon aren't the way out, I'm dead. I tried everything else. And that was my mantra. And as I say, that was August the 3rd, my little girl's birthday in 2003. It's been my mantra ever since. And I wish I could say that's the end of the story. I went to Donna and I had written the Snowmass Agreement out. It was about 25 points. You know, you get a sponsor, you go to a meeting every day, you'll take antabuse, you know. And Don said, Billy, Buttero, you're about the sickest Al-Anon I've ever seen. And so I kept believing that God was in charge, none of my business. And one time this same sponsee said, what do you mean, man? You're in his family. You're the father. You're the husband. What do you mean it's none of your business? So I came home one afternoon to have that same sponsee's birthday. I had forgotten his birthday. So to make amends, I was going to take coffee to the meeting. Because at the Tuesday night men's group, we don't have women. We don't have any bullshit. And we don't have coffee. And so I decided I'm going to take coffee. And, you know, of course, every self-respecting alcoholic has to have two great big coffee pots, you know. And I only had one, so I went home to get the other one. And as I pulled up to the house, which was my parents' home, I bought it from my dad when my mother died. And I pulled up, and there was my mother's ambulance. It was right there in the front of the house. It had to be hers. And there was my little girl standing out there with her little friends. And I went in to the maid, and the maid said, I'm so sorry, Mr. Mouthpiece. I thought I had to go on the down low all the time, but, you know, stay away from the popo. But I just had to call him because I thought Miss Mama was dead. And she was up against the door. Vomit all over, and she'd been shooting up fentanyl. You know, it's a really good stuff. You know, Earl Hightower always says, you know, when you take that stuff, you go, one, you know, and you're out. And he says, damn, if I'm not dead, I'm going to do that again as soon as I can. It's powerful stuff. I've never known an anesthesiologist that didn't get defrocked on the basis of fentanyl. It's a wonderful, very sophisticated drug. And so my little girl's therapist says, you better do something or I'm going to have to turn you over to Child Protective Services, which is not a great recommendation for a family law lawyer. And so I go through all this paperwork and put together a legal separation, and she's supposed to move out, and they called me up from the hospital. She had gone back to work. She'd been out for 10 years, and so she went to work in an operating room, which is like sending Jesse James to a bank, you know. And they called me up, and they say, we believe your wife's had a seizure, and you need to get over here right away. And I was thinking, yeah, I know what kind of seizure she's had. And so we had to send her away to treatment. And my little girl was very concerned that I was going to screw up her 10th birthday. Because her mother had always handled it. So I got a stretch limo navigator. And I went around, picked up her 10 little friends, gave them all Princess Diary movie in their little bags. And took him to Princess Diary, and she got to turn the movie on. And then brought her back to the house and had a swimming pool and ice cream and cake and great party that afternoon. Then we had the grandparents' party that night. I put a little weight on things sometimes. But I hadn't told her that I was going to sell the house in 2 days. And they put the sign in the yard a day early. So she called me up screaming and yelling. Oh, she was carrying on. I don't like that at the office. It's embarrassing. She and her little friends, they took the sign and they hid it. And they put up a lemonade stand, save the house. My little girl wrote a paper for this Duke program, an advanced student program. Why I'm so mad at my daddy. Be careful who you trust. You never can tell who will betray you. Even your own father. My father never told me he was selling the house that I had lived in all my life. He didn't even tell me, and he sold that house. It's fun to have published. I try to say it wasn't autobiographical. She's just got a wonderful imagination. Except for the problem, I had sold the house in 7 hours. Bang. I'll show you. You don't appreciate this house? You know? Okay. You know, it's gone. Goodbye. So I showed who was in power, who had the power. Yeah. That was a mistake. The next 54 days were pure hell. And everything went wrong in the world that could go wrong. And I don't have time to go through it. But, you know, ran the car into 3 posts. I lost 3 refrigerators full of food because of power outages. I hired 4 members of the home group to help the movers, not to be the movers, just to help the movers. And they all got stoned on crack, and wrecked the sponsor's 54 Cadillac, pristine Cadillac. They lost my little girl's dog. Pretty bad afternoon. And I went back to International Lawyers in AA, and I was telling this story, and a real tough guy named Tim from New Forge, New York. And he said, well, Billy, what are you doing to set all this up? Pardon? Did you not hear the story about Carolyn? Well, Billy, you're the one that says that the best promise in the whole big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is our troubles are of our own making. You know, we immortalized page 83, but I think our troubles are of our own making's a good one. Because you don't have to be a victim. There's a real problem with being a victim. If you're really a victim, then you're screwed. Because there's nothing you can do about it. And this being a people pleaser, I was telling that one time to Professor O'Keefe, and he said, "Oh, I see you're a people pleaser. What you mean is you're just dishonest. You won't give the people the truth and let them simply do with it what they need to do with it." So you'd think that, you know, certainly after all that, it's going to get great. And I had a total knee replacement last July. And I was going around on a cane, and it makes you a little grumpy when you have your leg amputated. And so I wasn't feeling that well, and I came home, and my wife was bleeding all over the bathroom. And she had a bleed, and she had her coumadin levels, her INR, was up to 5.5 because she was taking coumadin. So we rushed her to the hospital, and the ER doctor saved her life. And then they took her upstairs, and at 11:30 that night, they told me that they were going to take her off of life support. I said, no. This is my little girl's mother. We can't do that. Somehow they pulled it out. I had a Far Eastern Indian doctor. He said, Don't argue with me. I went to Harvard Medical School. You'll get it, and you'll get it now. And it's called Factor 7, and it's kind of like Fix-A-Flat, you know. It just turns all the INR into concrete. And they saved her. And goodness knows that'd be the end of the story, except about 3 weeks later, we get into this therapy with my little girl, and she wanted a dog, and another dog, and she wanted a golden doodle, and $800 for the dog. I, you know, can't you find a dog at the pound, you know? And so we're at the therapist, and she says, "You always lie to me. You told me I could have a dog." "Okay, Allie, you get the dog. But are there any other beefs here? Because I got to know. I can't take this any longer." And she said, "You think you're so smart. You're some kind of lawyer. I'll tell you what. I may or I may not forgive you for selling the house. But the reason I hate you is because you took us over to the mall and you bought me $9.95 worth of candy. And then you brought us home and you put us with the maid who I hate and that big booby nanny that you found and her druggy boyfriend. And you abandoned me as you sent my mother away to treatment. Okay, Allie." So, 2 days later, she calls me up. "Daddy, you got to come get me and Lena. Mama's too drunk to drive." This is 5 or 6 weeks after she's been dying in intensive care. And she's so loaded that she can't drive. So I wind up here, but God's grace is sufficient. I told a story at the Bar Association that we were doing through Epiphanies, and I told them my story, and I told them about Bob B. from Minnesota had challenged me one time to figure out one thing I ever did that I was proud of, really proud of, you know, hole in one or wedding or so. Carolyn came in. She said, "What'd you decide on?" "I don't know. You know, getting sober, I guess." She said, "Oh no, you've been just like your father. You stuck with me all these years. The idea I could be anything like my father." It's shocking. Don and I always say, we can get affidavits we weren't anything like our daddies. So it's been pretty exciting. She's got 5 months of sobriety now. And God's grace is sufficient. I always end with the same story about how much I hated myself when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in Washington, D.C. at Nathan's down in Georgetown. I was telling some girls some lies, and they asked me what I did for a living. So I told them I was Henry Kissinger's executive assistant. And had a little southern accent for that, but I thought I could make it fly. And it wasn't good enough that I was going to argue a case before the Supreme Court of the United States of America the next morning. I had to be somebody else. I couldn't stand who I was. So they told me when I got to AA that it was a lot like the story of Michelangelo. And they asked Michelangelo how he made that statue of David. It's 14 feet, 6 inches tall. And it's just like it's alive. And, he said, "Well, what I did is I got me a big old block of stone. And I got me some chisels. And I chipped away everything that didn't look like David. And this is what I got." And with me as a very willing block of stone, and you people as the chisels, in the big book. And God is the sculptor. We've been chipping away everything that doesn't look like Billy Hogue, the alcoholic, recovered. And this is what we got so far. Thanks a lot.